Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right, I'm back. Yep, there you go, and really glad to be back. Today's show, towards the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Larry Everest for an update on the whole situation with Iran, the possible growing threats of war, what's going on between the U.S. and Israel, and their view, and what they're trying to do with Iran, you know, against Iran. And before that, we'll be talking with Vazir Fatih. Vazir is the author of a newly released book, Interview with Galindo Pohl. And the book is about the testimony of political prisoners in meetings with an envoy of the UN. Vazir spent 10 years of his life in the torture chambers of the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1980, and we'll be talking about all that. But opening the show up, I'm really excited about doing this. And I'm going to start a whole new segment on the show that will appear in different spots on the show over the next few weeks between now and Election Day. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to be doing something called Give Me Some Truth, because one of the problems that we got here today, one of the problems that we seem to be really suffering under, and I think this is, you know, it's interesting. It's happened every time I do something that exposes the Obama regime for something, and especially in relation to this election, people start talking about how, you know, What are you doing? This is you need to actually recognize that he's the lesser of two evils, all this. Well, actually, what we need to do is we need to think about what's going on out here. Now, I don't want to be I do not want to be labeled as being somehow wanting Romney. That's not the situation. I also think that people need to think about this willful blinding of themselves and turning it around so it becomes we're voting for the lesser of two evils. There is no lesser of two evils. They are both evil. All right. And one of them just happens to be sitting in the White House right now and ruling the world. And I think it's extremely important that we open our eyes up, that we stop blinding ourselves and we begin to take into account what the hell is going on and what it means for what we need to do. So I'm going to be playing an excerpt from Bob Avakian's talk on communism and Jeffersonian democracy. And that excerpt has everything to do with what does and does not happen through elections, what is and what is not meaningful political activity. And although this talk was given in 2006, and so it didn't take into account the Obama phenomenon, everything that in here that is in this talk is exceedingly relevant for today and actually has even more power in the situation today. So without any further ado, this is Bob Avakian, and what does and does not happen through elections, what is and is not meaningful political activity.
And it is not just experience in this immediate period, but experience throughout the history of this country that has illustrated time and again, one, there is a ruling class that has interests which are very different from and fundamentally in opposition to those of the masses of citizens. Two, this ruling class in reality exercises a dictatorship, that is, a monopoly of political power backed up by and concentrated in a monopoly of armed power over the rest of society. And those who at any given time are administering that dictatorship will continue to pursue policies they are determined to carry out, even in the face of massive popular opposition, unless and until the larger interests of the ruling class dictate that it modify or even abandon a particular policy, or until that ruling class is overthrown. And three, elections will not provide an avenue for the realization of the desire of masses of people to see these policies and actions of the government changed. Although mass political resistance can, under certain circumstances, play a very important part in forcing changes in government policy, especially if this takes place in a larger context where these policies are running into real trouble and, among other things, are leading to heightened divisions within the ruling class itself. In that context, massive resistance can not only play an important part, but can have a significant impact. And if we look at more recent history, stepping back a few decades, we can see once again how the experience around Vietnam was a concentrated example of all this. I pointed to this before, but there were two elections in relation to Vietnam that were of great significance and pointed to as having great significance, which actually illustrate what I'm saying and debunk the notions that Dahl is putting forward. First, there was election in 1964 when the U.S. began to significantly escalate its involvement, quote-unquote, in Vietnam. This is one of the two elections for president of the United States that I actually voted for. It was the first one I was eligible to vote for, and I voted for Lyndon Johnson in 1964. I voted for Eldridge Cleaver in 1968, but that was a different story. But at the time, there was a very intense debate in the movement about whether or not to vote, and in particular, obviously, to vote for Johnson. Johnson was coming out on, you know, behalf of civil rights, making concessions in that whole arena to the massive upsurge. And at the same time, he was, by contrast with Goldwater, even while as president he was carrying out an escalation of the war, he was doing it while not talking in the crazy and extreme terms that his rival, the Republican candidate Goldwater, was. Goldwater was famous, or some would say infamous, for his statement at the time of his nomination at the Republican convention in 1964 that moderation, let me see if I can get it right, extremism in the pursuit of virtue is no crime, and moderation in the pursuit of vice is no virtue, or something like that. In other words, extremism is good if it's for the right things, to boil it down to the essence. And he was talking in extreme terms about Vietnam, bombing them back to the Stone Age, or language similar to that. And everyone was arguing that for these reasons, in particular with Vietnam in mind, you had to vote for Johnson. It was absolutely essential, you know, in terms of Vietnam as well as other things, to vote for Johnson. And I and some others that I knew were influenced and persuaded by this, and we went and held our noses, as people often do these days, and voted for Lyndon Johnson. And after the election was over and after Johnson had run his campaign ads talking about the extreme danger of what Goldwater would do in Vietnam, Johnson proceeded to massively escalate the war in Vietnam, both in bombing and in terms of beginning what became the process of sending hundreds of thousands more troops to Vietnam, which by the late 60s reached the level of 500,000. And of course, those of us who had been persuaded and cajoled and perhaps in retrospect coerced into voting for Johnson felt bitterly betrayed by this, and it was a very acute lesson.
You're listening to an excerpt from a talk given by Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, back in 2006, and it's a talk called Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. And specifically what we're talking about today is what does and does not happen through elections. What is and is not meaningful political activity?
By the time the 1972 elections came around, and I spoke to this somewhat in my memoir, there was a big debate even inside of the forerunner of the party, the Revolutionary Union at that time, as well as much more broadly among the forces opposed, you know, in the movement broadly and those opposed to the Vietnam War, about whether or not it was necessary to vote for McGovern or put it another way, against Nixon. There were those, you know, such as Label Bergman, whom I mentioned in the memoir, within the RU, the Revolutionary Union, who were arguing that it was our internationalist duty to the Vietnamese people to vote for McGovern and get Nixon out, because otherwise Nixon would escalate the war in Vietnam again and McGovern would bring an end to the war. Well, this time we didn't go for it. We had a lot of struggle. We examined the question seriously. We didn't just apply a dogmatic approach. I remember being up many nights agonizing, well, you know, over the question of, is this a particular set of circumstances which requires an exception to the general approach of not supporting or even holding your nose and voting for bourgeois electoral candidates? And coming to the conclusion on the basis of a lot of agonizing and wrangling with others that no, that this was not our, quote-unquote, our internationalist duty to the Vietnamese people, and our internationalist duty was better served by continuing to build mass resistance to that war as well as to the overall policies of the government and more fundamentally to the system, which is what we set out to do. But there were many who did get drawn into the whole McGovern thing. I mean, it would have been, it'd be interesting for those of you who weren't around at the time or paying attention to go back and look at films, if they are available, of a Democratic convention. I mean, it was, you know, it was, there was Jerry Rubin. All these other movement people were being welcomed into the killing embrace, brought back within the suffocating confines and some of them feeling a certain sense of relief in believing that after years of trying to struggle to change things outside these confines, maybe there could be an avenue for doing so inside. And of course, what happened in reality is that Nixon trounced McGovern in the elections. It was more or less through the machinery of bourgeois electoral politics and bourgeois politics in a more general sense set up that way. I mean, without going into too many particulars, McGovern was barely out of the gate running when his running mate, the vice presidential nominee, Thomas Eagleton, was exposed as having been a mental case and having sought psychiatric help, and so then he had to replace him with Sergeant Shriver of the Kennedy clan. And the whole thing was a debacle from the beginning, and Nixon won almost every state. And many people were demoralized by this, but what happened? Without going into all the international and other factors that fed into this, but to a significant degree because of this continuing struggle of the Vietnamese people and massive opposition to what the U.S. imperialism was doing in Vietnam, Nixon was forced to sign an agreement within a few months after the election, which led first to the withdrawal of U.S. troops and an attempt at Vietnamization, getting the Vietnamese to more fully fight the war with U.S. air power, and then led to the ultimate and very welcome defeat of imperialism and its puppet government in South Vietnam within 2 years, by 1975. You all seen those scenes that they lament so much, of the people scrambling to get on the helicopters, grabbing as it leaves the U.S. embassy, as the National Liberation Front troops kick down the gate and the fence to the U.S. embassy in Saigon in 1975. Now, the important lesson for what we're talking about here is that in neither case, in neither 1964 nor in 1972, were the decisive elements of what went into the changes that came about brought about through the election. Quite the contrary. In 64, we voted for someone who wouldn't escalate the Vietnam War, and he escalated on a massive scale. In 72, many people voted against Nixon because he was going to escalate the war further, and he was forced to pull out. And that led to the ultimate defeat of the U.S. and its puppet government in South Vietnam. So in both cases, the seeming logic and the compelling pull that you cannot allow a horror like Goldwater or a horror like Nixon, and you've got to vote for the alternative because at least it won't be as bad, or maybe it'll even be much better, was not borne out at all in reality, because these elections are not the actual dynamics through which these decisions are made. They are not the actual forces compelling these changes of one kind or another. And this is, again, dramatically illustrated if you look at these two elections, which in effect bracket the heavy involvement of the U.S. in Vietnam, 1964 in the one case and 1972 in the other. Let's have an exercise and let anyone explain to us how holding your nose and voting for the Democrat, or enthusiastically voting for the Democrat in either or both cases, led to and was responsible for changes of the one kind, negative or positive. It didn't happen that way because those are not the real dynamics and the real basis on which changes of one kind or another are brought about.
You're listening to an excerpt from a talk given by Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, back in 2006, and it's a talk called Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. And specifically what we're talking about today is, what does and does not happen through elections? What is and is not meaningful political activity?
And this is obviously extremely relevant now, where there is this massive, widespread hatred, in certain ways unprecedented in its scale and even in some senses in its depth, although there was a depth of hatred for Nixon that may have even surpassed this. But in many ways, unprecedented hatred for the head of government and for the whole regime associated with that head of government. And yet people have great difficulty rupturing with the notion that the only possible avenue for changing the course of things in a significant and qualitative way is to get sucked back into the same dynamics which are set up to and which can only serve the interests of the ruling class, and which have not and do not provide the means and channels through which changes in the interests of the people can be brought about. So in light of all this, we can see the fundamental error reflected in Dahl's assertion that, quote, the capacity of citizens to exercise a veto over the re-election and policies of elected officials is a powerful and frequently exercised means of preventing officials from imposing policies objectionable to many citizens. The means through which that happens is massive upsurge in resistance in combination with other factors going on, including resistance and struggle and revolution in other parts of the world, as well as other contradictions that the imperialists are running up against, even short of revolution to overthrow them. That is the means through which officials are prevented from continuing to impose policies objectionable to many people or many citizens. And here we get to the fundamental point that what Dahl extols here clearly amounts to a vision of a good society, in fact, of the best possible society, according to people like Dahl, in which the role of the masses of people, of the citizens, as they might put it, is reduced to one of acting as a check on the elites who actually make political decisions. It is another expression of the notion that the best possible political system is one in which there is not one supposedly uniform and monolithic elite, but competing elites. And the quote-unquote freedom of the masses of people, including the preservations of their human rights and liberties, resides ultimately in their ability to choose and perhaps maneuver between competing elites, and presumably to make the elites compete for their support, particularly as this takes place through elections. Well, to begin to refute this, or to refute it further, in order to show what it amounts to in reality, and to make clear that there is a much better kind of society in which the role of the masses of people as the masters of society is not only expressed much more fully, but takes place on a qualitatively different and whole greater dimension, let's begin with the exposition of basic fact that is concentrated in the following from Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? Speaking to the essential nature and role of elections as the ultimate expression of democracy in bourgeois society. And there it says, quote, to state it in a single sentence, elections are controlled by the bourgeoisie, are not the means through which basic decisions are made in any case, and are really for the primary purpose of legitimizing the system and the policies and actions of the ruling class, giving them the mantle of a popular mandate, and of channeling, confining, and controlling the political activity of the masses of people.
You're listening to an excerpt from a talk given by Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, back in 2006, and it's a talk called Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. And specifically what we're talking about today is what does and does not happen through elections. What is and is not meaningful political activity?
To illustrate this further, and what is wrong with this notion of influencing the competing elites, as much as I love Malcolm X, I have to speak to limitations of his, which ultimately flowed from the fact that in the final analysis, his outlook was not that of the proletariat and of communism, although his development was in motion and was cut short by his death. In a speech that I referred to in the memoir, in which I listened to over and over again, and which I still love in many ways, The Ballot or the Bullet, Malcolm goes into this whole thing about how people shouldn't be slavishly dependent upon and loyal to the Democrats. And he even analyzed how the Democrats and the Republicans, I don't know, those of you familiar with the speech, are, you know, of the same species. They're both canines, both dogs, you know. One's a wolf and one's a fox, and on he goes like that. But in the end, what he proposes is a familiar device. Namely, he says, we shouldn't just be a tail on the Democrats. They take us for granted. He goes into the whole thing about, you know, Lyndon Johnson, you know, and when he first became president, and he gets off the plane and he looks around for his friend Richard Russell, a Southern segregationist Democrat. You know, he says, he gets off the plane, and what does he do? He says, "Where's Dickie?" Now, who's Dickie? He's old Southern segregationist, white supremacist Richard Russell. No, that man is just too tricky because his best friend is still old Dickie. But what does Malcolm end up saying? Well, we shouldn't trust those Democrats. Look whom Johnson is in bed with, for example. And where does Johnson? Says some people argue that Johnson can handle the Southern segregationists because he's from Texas and he knows them. He said, well, if that's the argument, what about Eastland, who was like an even more overt segregationist? He knows the Southerners even better. Why don't we have Eastland for president? So he does a lot of time punching holes in this idea of relying on the Democrat. But then ultimately, what does he say? Well, we should form a bloc. And then the Republicans will have to come to us, and the Democrats will have to come to us, and we'll go whichever one will do more for us. But what are the actual dynamics when this has been attempted? The Democrats come to you, and you put a bunch of demands on them and say, now, if you don't do this, and you don't do this, and you don't do this in our interest, why, we'll what? We'll vote for the Republicans? You see, that's it. You got the wolf and the fox, and one of them pretends to be for you, and the other one doesn't even pretend to be for you. And those are your choices. So, you know, what leverage do you have in this game? If the Democratic Party's role is to talk sometimes in terms that make you think that maybe with enough pressure applied to them, you can make them adopt some of the things that you think are urgently needed, and you try to put pressure on them to actually do that by threatening to vote for the Republicans, either openly or behind closed doors, they must laugh uproariously. Because they know you can't go and vote for the Republicans who don't even pretend to be for those things. So you have, even on those terms and on that level, you have no leverage against them. They have you, you don't have them. As long as you're looking at things as being concentrated within and finding their only possible or their best possible expression within these, yes, very killing confines. And it's only by breaking out of these confines to begin with that you can actually begin to influence things in a significant way. And by going up against the whole operation of this machinery and breaking free of it and challenging it in a fundamental way.
You're listening to an excerpt from a talk given by Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, back in 2006. And it's a talk called Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. And specifically what we're talking about today is what does and does not happen through elections? What is and is not meaningful political activity?
Now, here the following from Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? Helps again to provide a concentrated summation of crucial points that are at issue here. Quote, many will say, how can the political system in a democracy, in a democratic country like the U.S., quote, serve to maintain the rule of the bourgeoisie over the proletariat when everyone has the right to choose the political leaders by participating in elections? The answer to this is that elections in such a society and the democratic process as a whole are a sham, and more than a sham, a cover for and indeed a vehicle through which domination over the exploited and oppressed is carried out by the exploiting, oppressing ruling class. In order to have a deeper and more solid foundation for a correct understanding of this question, and to recognize more fully how apologies for bourgeois democracy, like that of Dahl, represent fundamental distortions of reality, it is crucial to turn once again to the question of outlook and method, to the decisive importance of dialectical materialism, and on the other hand, the striking lack of materialism and lack of dialectics grounded in materialism in bourgeois democratic views and analyses. Now, I've spoken in other contexts to how the superstructure in any society, including in a the society with which we're familiar, the U.S., does and fundamentally can only correspond to the character of the economic base. In other words, to the underlying social and above all production relations in which a capitalist class predominates in the ownership of the crucial means of production and in which others either have none of those means of production and therefore are forced to work for the capitalist class, which does, or have very little of them, and thereby constitute either the proletariat in the one case or the petty bourgeoisie in the other. And I've spoken to how if the superstructure, if the politics, the political processes, institutions, policies, and so on, come into any kind of serious conflict with the dynamics of that underlying economic base and the process of capitalist accumulation which drives it forward and shapes its character, if it comes into that kind of fundamental conflict, then chaos will result, the whole functioning of society will be disrupted, and unless you're prepared to follow that through to its full conclusion, in other words, to the overthrow of the system, you will be forced to recoil from that and to adopt and to adjust policies so that they come once again back into conformity with the fundamental nature and functioning of the underlying economic base and the whole process of capitalist accumulation as it takes place and takes shape, not only in the particular country, but today more than ever on an international scale. Understanding this is crucial to understanding how and why things happen the way they do, including in particular how and why politicians always act the way they do. Why repeatedly everybody, even those who can't help themselves and go do it again, everybody has had this Charlie Brown with Lucy experience. You know, the famous thing of like she's going to hold a football for him to kick it, and the last minute she pulls it out and he keeps falling for it. She keeps doing it, you know, the Peanuts cartoon. Everybody's had this experience with the Democrats, or almost everybody, who's gotten involved in mainstream politics in one way or another. They send out the candidates. Remember in the 2004 election, they had this whole traveling road show, and they had Al Sharpton out there, and they had Dennis Kucinich, and they articulated some of what people wanted to hear, but Time magazine declared early on in the process, well, Sharpton gets the best popular response, but he's not a serious candidate. Why is he not a serious candidate? Not because Sharpton's a revolutionary, but because even the things Sharpton said, however sincerely he may or may not have believed them, even those things were outside the pale of what the Democratic Party could actually seriously pursue, even in an election, let alone what it could actually do if it came into office. And from the beginning, those, you know, conscious representatives of the ruling class were very well aware of that. Sharpton, whatever his individual intentions, performed a function, objectively, of drawing people who have a lot of progressive inclinations and are very dissatisfied or even deeply dissatisfied with the whole direction of things back into this bourgeois framework. And Sharpton actually articulated this competing elites. Recently, I saw him on, you know, one of these news channels. He explicitly articulated the competing elites theory, that the role of the masses is to influence what the elites do. And he sees his own position and his own function in relation to that role. But he was not, quote unquote, not a serious candidate, nor was Kucinich, because that had nothing to do with what the actual dynamics of the system were bringing forth and required. And so then you ended up with Kerry, and we all know what that was about, and it's the same Lucy and Charlie Brown over and over again. Maybe this time they'll actually hold the football. No. This time they will do what they always do, leaving you feeling the blues the day after, because that's in line with what their role is, not in some sort of otherworldly sense or some rigid dogmatic sense, but it's in line with the actual functioning of the economic base to which they, in an overall and ultimate sense, have to correspond and which they have to serve. Through a lot of complexity and struggle, this gets worked out, but that's what it ultimately gets shaped by and fundamentally is shaped by.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, and that was from a talk called Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy, and it was a section of the talk dealing with what does and does not happen through elections, what is and is not meaningful political activity. And like I said, you know, given that this was done in 2006, but if you look at the questions that are posed for all of us today that are out there now that are being debated over or need to be debated over, there's not enough debate over them. If you look at those questions, this is more relevant than ever. Granted, it's not – back then it was not the Obama phenomenon, and today it is. But that makes it even more important that we dig into exactly this question. What is meaningful political activity and what isn't meaningful political activity? If you want to hear the whole speech, you can. You can find it at bobavakian.net. You'll find a lot of his talks there, and Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy is the name of that talk. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Wazir Fati about his experience in the Iranian torture chambers for 10 years. So don't miss that. Stay tuned.
I waited all my life to play, but I still can't find a way.
All right, welcome back. That's Lupe Fiasco with Break the Chain. And we're now going to be joined by Wazir Fati. Wazir is the author of a newly released book, Interview with Galindo Pohl, a book of the testimony of political prisoners in meetings with an envoy of the UN. And those political prisoners were in the torture chambers, the dungeons of Iran under the Islamic fundamentalist regime. Wazir spent 10 years of his life in those torture chambers. Wazir, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Good, fine. How are you? Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you.
You were a prisoner in Iran for 10 years in the 1980s. Were you a political prisoner?
Greeting
to all the audience, and I would like to say yes, I was political prisoner when I was in the prison for 10 years, between the years of 1983 and 1992, and I spent my time in Evin, Gohardasht, and Ghazal Hisar. These are the three names of the infamous prisons in Iran.
Can you give people a sense of what had happened in Iran and what was going on at the time you were arrested?
هنگامی که من دستگیر شدم در ایران جمهوری اسلامی رژیم سیاسی بود که بعد از یک قیام و انقلاب
Yes, when I was arrested and the political situation was right after the uprising or revolution in terms, there was a sudden turnaround that the regime was able to consolidate its power. And it was a kind of approach to the kind of new generation who took to the streets to be able to actually turn that around. In order to do that, they had to eliminate all those revolutionary generations. And what they did, they started suppression of the heaviest kind by mass arrests and executions.
Well, now, there were a tremendous number of executions. I mean, it really was in that first period of immediately after the seizure of power. The overthrow of the Shah, there was a lot of upheaval in the streets. And then there was that whole period. And like you were saying, the idea that there was this, you know, mass upsurge and then this horrific onslaught of repression and oppression that, you know, in massacres, imprisonment, all these things. There were literally thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people were thrown in jails. Now, what were the conditions in the prisons when you went in there? What did people face when they went into prison?
به عنوان پیش مقدمه البته جمله رو عرض می کنم تا به اون قسمت سوالتون هم
Before I start answering your question in depth, I would like to give a certain kind of introduction. And that introduction is that it wasn't easy for the regime to basically turn everything around easily. Because there was a conscious generation, revolutionary, radical, people with the vision of the freedom and liberation. And that wouldn't have been easy for the system that be to be able to crush that in a very simple manner. The regime started in the 1980s with all kinds of different ways in which extended the networks of arrest and executions. And primarily they started to go in the areas that were uprising. It was waves of revolutionaries were still going on. And that's how they started to go after that new generation that had risen up.
I think that's a really important point that Vazir is making in terms of the what was the climate at the time. It wasn't easy to just go out and crush that. And it did dictate that the regime went out and did some very brutal things and very focused and very targeted sweeps of people. And you ended up with many thousands of people in jail. Now, again, if we could give people a sense of what were the conditions in the prison, once people went into the prisons, what were the conditions that people faced there?
وضعیت زندان ها به طرزی بود که من با توجه به این که درست
It took about a year after the whole height of the arrestment, mass arrestment and imprisonment that I was also was captured and put in jail. But in that year, I was able also to see the atmosphere outside the jails in the society was horrendous. But when I actually went to the jail, it was the time that the mass harassment was taking place, not only tens and hundreds. You would see that daily thousands of people were arrested and brought to the prisons here and there. I was myself in Evin at that point, and even all the hallways were full. And not only were full, but also we were able to hear the torture and how these revolutionaries and freedom lovers under the torture were crying and screaming and shouting.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Vazir Fatih. Vazir was he's a former political prisoner in Iran, spent 10 years between 1983 and 1992 in the torture chambers of the Islamic fundamentalist regime in Iran. And he's the author of a newly released book, Interview with Galindo Pohl, a book of the testimony of political prisoners in meetings with an envoy of the UN. And Vazir is talking with us about the conditions inside the prison, but also about what the climate was like and the focus of all this on the revolutionary movement in Iran at that time.
سال 1360 یعنی از همون آغاز در واقع دوره عظیم سرکوب ها شب ها همین بدن های مجروح
Yeah, I was there talking about the situation in prisons and especially at nights. We were able to see that bloodied, bruised bodies, broken bones, combats, coming to the prisons. We were in the cell number 4, and we were able to hear things outside the jail, which we thought it was a construction was going on, that the big trucks were unloading things. We didn't understand at that point that those noises were the machine guns. And after those machine guns, which we at that point, at a certain point, we thought it was a construction going on, we were hearing single shots. And it was after that we realized that those single shots was the shots to the heads of the revolutionaries who actually, after the execution with machine gun, they were shot to death, making sure that they are dead. Their half-lived bodies been actually, shot. And that was at that point that we were actually sitting and counting at time, 100 gunshots, 80, 120, 40. And that was the situation that we arrived. We realized that we could count how many prisoners were executed that day.
Hmm. In 1988, well, actually right now, this year marks the 24th anniversary of a time when things took a leap to a whole other, more intense, more repulsive, more just outrageous level. And that was the massacre in 1988, a massive massacre of political prisoners, and something that was actually, according to a number of people, was actually unprecedented in the history of Iran, that kind of wholesale slaughter of revolutionaries, communists, and opponents to the regime, progressive and political opponents to the regime. Vazir, you were in prison at that time. What can you tell us about that, how that developed, and what was behind it, and what happened then?
عزیز میدونیم که سال 1988 تابستان 67 مهمترین in the height of the 1988 in the prison system it was about a year or two or three that the regime was able to establish its authority and was consolidating every echelon of the power outside the society, outside the world. Almost I could say with certainty that almost the only trench that was existing in Iran who was fighting and exposing the regime was the trenches in the jail, in the jails, in prisons, that the different the generation of the revolutionaries, freedom lovers, in that point, they were actually standing up and actually exposing the regime. And it was at that time that the regime could not tolerate that. And they had planned. It took 2 years for them to plan to come down with this final solution, if you want to call it that way, for the mass executions of the political prisoners.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Vazir Fatih. Vazir was he's a former political prisoner in Iran, spent 10 years between 1983 and 1992 in the torture chambers of the Islamic fundamentalist regime in Iran. And he's the author of a newly released book, Interview with Galindo Pohl, a book of the testimony of political prisoners in meetings with an envoy of the UN. And Vazir is talking with us about the conditions inside the prison, but also about what the climate was like and the focus of all this on the revolutionary movement in Iran at that time.
تدارک این کشتار عظیم در از دو سال پیش در واقع تو فکرش بودن مشخص بود قرائن و شواهدش برای
At the time that they started the Evin massacre was the July 28, 1988. That was the beginning at the Evin in Tehran. And 2 days after, that was extended to the Gohardasht carriage in July 30th, 1988. And this was done by bringing forward what they called Death Commission. Nayiri, Eshravi, and also Pul Mohammadi. These were the elements that they were in the different position at that point, and with the help of the governor of the prison in Gohardasht carriage, Nasirian, they started another round of execution in Karaj.
هیئت که اومده بود و من توضیح دادم در بیان زندانیان به نام هیئت مرگ مشهور.
This death commission spent only maybe a minute or two with each prisoner. They lined them all up, had one question or two questions in total silence. And they asked people, would you stay in your position? Are you continue to be who you are, or are you going to retain and actually speak up and basically sell out? What they did, majority of the people did not, and they took them to the amphitheater in Gohardasht. They hung them there because they did not have equipment enough as it being to execute them with the gunshot, but they basically hang them. In a month and a half, thousands and thousands of people were basically hung to death in Gohardasht and shot to death.
Vazir, thank you very much for joining us today. And I'm going to have to wrap this up, but I want to add on to the point that you were making towards the end, that these revolutionaries and communists stood up and stood for what they believed in. They inspired people. The regime was not able to break them. But the world stood by silent. To a large degree, it is still standing by silent. And that's something we can't allow to continue, both in terms of the past repression of revolutionaries and communists in Iran, as well as the current repression practiced against all those who stand up and oppose the Iranian regime, the Islamic fundamentalist regime in Iran. But we also have to remain vigilant and not silent in the face of these continuing threats of war that loom large over Iran. We got to be very, very attuned to that and not stand silent. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have been talking with Vazir Fatih. Vazir is a writer and a former political prisoner who did 10 years in the Iranian torture chambers from the early 1980s to the early 1990s. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Larry Everest, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we'll be continuing our conversation on Iran, so stay tuned. Back. That was Children of Babylon from Lily Hayden. Joining us now to continue our conversation about Iran is Larry Everest. Larry is a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and he traveled to Iran in 1979 and 1980, shortly after the revolution, reporting from Iranian Kurdistan on both his trips and interviewed Islamic militants holding the U.S. Embassy in 1980. Everest witnessed firsthand the beginning of the Islamic Republic's crackdown against its opponents and critics, including communists, radical Democrats, intellectuals, women, and oppressed nationalities like the Kurds. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
You know, Larry, we just finished speaking with Wazir Fati about his experience as a political prisoner in Iran from the early 1980s to the early 1990s. And, you know, as I was talking to Wazir, I kept thinking there's probably a lot of people who really have no idea what it was like back then. What was going on? Why was there such a crackdown? Where did the crackdown come from? And there's even probably a lot of people that they weren't even alive or old enough to remember the Shah's regime, the massive upheaval that happened to get rid of the Shah's regime, and then how the Islamic fundamentalist regime came in. Can you talk about what was happening in 1979? I mean, you were there, as I was saying.
Yeah, I got there several months after the revolution. And I have to say, I'd never witnessed anything like this before or since. Tehran is a big city, I can't remember, 5-10 million people at that point. You know, in some ways it's like New York, but just think of New York City, Manhattan. You have a tidal wave of postering and graffiti as high as the arm can reach, sweeping through that whole city, not a few here and a few there, but through that whole city. And it just struck me when I was there what this represented in terms of the tens of millions of people who turned out and participated in this truly massive upheaval. At one particular protest before I was there during the revolution in December 1978, over a quarter of the Iranian population took to the streets, some 10 million people. So there was this huge tidal wave. And the other thing that was really important to understand was the Islamic Republic at that point had just taken power, led by Ayatollah Khomeini. But it was not fully clear exactly what sort of an Islamic Republic it was going to be. Was it going to be an out-and-out theocracy? Was it going to be a bit more tolerant and democratic and so on? And what you had as part of this massive upheaval was the tremendous politicization of the population and the emergence of all kinds of revolutionary and radical nationalist, revolutionary sort of semi-Islamic sorts of trends. I mean, I would go to these demonstrations of the left or the Mujahideen. At that point, they had not become counter-revolutionaries and agents of imperialism, which is what they are now. But these big demonstrations of the left, you'd have 20,000 people, you'd have 50,000 people in front of Tehran University, I remember. Everybody would put their books out on the sidewalk, and you'd have Marx and Lenin and Mao and all these different kind of political revolutionary posters, as well as radical Iranian poets and intellectuals and so on. So there was a real flowering and emergence of very radical and revolutionary currents in Iran. I went up to Kurdistan in 1979 to Sanandaj, and look, it was the radical and revolutionary nationalists who were running the show. It was quite a trip to drive up there. And it's the radicals that are running the checkpoints, not the reactionaries. So it was an amazing scene.
So where did the crackdown come in? When did this crackdown start? I mean, we had talked with Wazir, and he talked about a first wave of arrests and executions that began in the early 1980s. And then we later got in and talked about the one that came in 1988. But how did this develop? How did this go from the scene you're describing early on in the revolution and the scene that developed in terms of the crackdowns and the executions?
Well, this began when I was there. I went to a demonstration in August 1979 in support of the magazine Ayin Dagan. It was just like The Nation, sort of a liberal democratic, but critical of theocracy. And it's the only demonstration I've ever been in. There were probably 100,000 people out there. It's the only demonstration I've ever been in where people were killed. And we were assaulted by these theocratic Hezbollah Hezbollah thugs, and that's what they were, a bunch of thugs. Some guy grabbed me and, you know, where are you from? Canada, Canada. You know, he had a three-foot-long piece of pipe. We just got away from him. The guy I was with, the Iranian guy I was with, got hit in the head with a very hard dirt clod. I had to grab his hand and pick him up and get him out of there. It was a vicious assault to shut down this magazine by the clerics. So they were moving even then to try to consolidate power and institute this very reactionary religious-based theocracy. In March, before I had been there, they attacked women's on Women's Day for protesting the wearing of the hijab, which is the scarf, traditional Islamic dress, but also a symbol that women are property and second-class citizens without full rights, that are under the thumb of men. So women in Iran righteously got out and protested this edict by Khomeini and were attacked. Now, when I came back to Iran in the spring of 1980 during the hostage crisis, the scene was very, very chilled. You did not have these massive expressions by the left. The regime had cracked down. It had used the embassy crisis and seizure in order to try to posture as some kind of a force against imperialism and attack all of its critics as being in favor of the United States, which, of course, wasn't at all true. And I went to Kurdistan during that trip as well, and we were under military attack. I remember we were going up there in a bus, and these jets were flying overhead, strafing positions in the distance. And, of course, these were the American-made F-4s supplied by the United States, probably flown by pilots trained by the United States from the Shah's regime. The Islamic Republic did not totally get rid of the Shah's military. And then, of course, this escalated after that in 1981, 1982, 1983. There was an uprising in Amul by communists in 1981. This was one of the things that had happened. Other groups were fighting the regime, and during that period, thousands of people were rounded up and thrown into these torture dungeons that the Islamic Republic was running.
We're talking with Larry Evers, the journalist with Revolution Newspaper. Now, Larry, what I want to talk to you about now, and we have just a few minutes left to talk about this, what I want to talk to you about now is this. We've talked with Vazir, and we've listened to what you're saying. We've talked with Vazir, and we've gotten a sense of just how reactionary this regime is. But for a lot of people, I think there's a lot of confusion. People feel like they're stuck on the horns of a dilemma. If they act against or they speak out against the Islamic fundamentalist regime, to do so, that means that they would have to support the U.S. Or if they want to speak out against the U.S., they feel like they have to throw in with the Islamic fundamentalist regime. What can you say about that?
Well, we have to bring forward a different way, because in fact, this clash between U.S. imperialism or imperialism generally and Islamic fundamentalism, jihadism, and so on, is a clash between two reactionary, outmoded social forces. Oppressive strata within the third world or developing world up against oppressive, outmoded strata in the imperialist world. And, of course, it's U.S. imperialism that is the far, far greater problem in the world and has in many ways really created this by installing one dictator, one oppressive regime after the other across the Middle East and the world. And, of course, a prime example of that is the Shah's regime in Iran that was installed in a CIA coup in 1953 and in many ways paved the way for the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, including the Shah's assaults on the communists and the left. But I think the thing people have to understand about this is these two outmoded, even as they're clashing with each other, they're reinforcing each other. For example, in 1979, the U.S. in many ways helped the Islamic Republic come to power and take power, because the U.S. feared that if it told the Shah's army to really go after this revolution, it would have further radicalized the situation, and the initiative would have passed to these left and communist groups that I was talking about. I mean, at that time, unfortunately, there was no revolutionary communist vanguard to really lead this whole thing, but that was emerging. So the U.S., in effect, somewhat similar to what they did in Afghanistan, organizing the jihadists and what would later become al-Qaeda and the Taliban against the Soviet invasion there. Not that the Soviets were leftists, they were imperialists, but this was in many ways how imperialism directly reinforced fundamentalism. And I think it's very important to understand that because of this, if you side with either of these forces, you end up strengthening the other. If you side with the Islamic Republic, you're strengthening imperialism because the Islamic Republic has no ability or desire to break with global imperialism. It occupies, in many ways, the exact same position the Shah's regime did in the world global capitalist economy as an oil producer and supplier. Now, politically, there are differences. So the most important thing, the thing we really need to do, is bring forward another liberating revolutionary way. And I just, you know, I do want to really say, I listened to Vazir, and it was so inspiring and important to know there are Iranians who reject both war and imperialism and Islamic fundamentalism.
All right.
That's tremendously important. The other thing, I think, is the more that a visible force emerges in the U.S. that protests and opposes the crimes of this government and the justification of the U.S. rulers, whether it be Obama, Romney, or whomever, the better conditions are created for the emergence of a liberatory force around the world. And then finally, I would highly encourage people to take a look at the manifesto from the RCP, Communism, the Beginning of a New Stage, which really talks about how to launch a new stage of communist revolution that can go further and do better than the revolutions of the past. And it's really the only fundamental solution to all this horrors that we see around the world.
All right, Larry, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Michael.
Okay, talk to you again soon, man. All right, that brings our show to an end for this week. I want to thank each and every one of my guests today. I want to thank my production assistant, Henry Carson, and my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a new song from a new album by Jimmy Cliff, World Upside Down.
Spinning around, I said the world is upside down.